Morning, Dr. Chen. How are you doing?
Great. How are you?
Yeah, I'm really well. Thank you for asking. So I just want to ask you first up, the crossbenchers who kind of triggered this double dissolution, do you think many of them will survive this coming election and go into another term?
I think it's generally unlikely. I mean, there's two things I think it's worth kind of commenting. There was a lot of kind of loose talk before the vote on the ABCC that, you know, and people recycled this kind of quote by the former Prime Minister that, you know, you should never stand between people and self-interest. But the senators actually followed, you know, their principles that they said they were going to follow and acted against really their self-interest. And they've been described in parts of the media as a suicide squad because of that. but it just shows you that, you know, some of the way that we talk about politicians is a little unfair and demeaning in practicality.
Mm.
And a few of those people are definitely not coming back. So they've given up 3 years of extremely well-paid,
yes,
lucrative position in the Senate. So we should keep that in mind next time we kind of slam politicians as being self-interested.
Mm.
Jackie Lambie, I think, is one who's got a high probability of coming back. She comes from a very small jurisdiction, Tasmania. With the double dissolution, it halves the quota, the number of votes she actually needs to get to be re-elected. She has a relatively high profile and some issues that she's really strongly associated with to the exclusion of others. So she's managed to stake out this space around the treatment of veterans and the armed forces. I think people in that policy area would say she may not be the most productive kind of spokesperson for those issues.
Mm-hmm.
But for the electors, they see her talking about it. We have pretty strong confidence that Nick Xenophon, who's a relatively well-established player on the political scene, is going to get back. He might pull in another senator as part of the Nick Xenophon team down there in South Australia. He's got some other candidates running in other places, so he has someone running against Tony Abbott in his electorate, but they're extremely unlikely to get up. And the other one I'm keeping an eye on would be Glenn Lazarus in Queensland, partly because Queensland is, to use a kind of loose term, a swing state or a key state. It is, you know, its politics are very on the knife edge up there with regards to their state election. In the lower house, we're talking about the Senate, but the lower house itself, it has the highest proportion of marginal seats in Australia. So the leaders are going to spend a lot of time up there. There's going to be a lot of focus up there. Lazarus himself has a profile. He has a new political party called the Glenn Lazarus Team, in case you've forgotten that he's a sportsman. And I think he's become a relatively sympathetic figure. But people like Ricky Muir, I think, are not long for this world. Ricky, you know, talks about how he's recently found his feet. Unfortunately, he's going to be knocked off, I think, in this coming election. Yeah.
Right. And let's talk about yesterday. There were whispers that sections of the budget were leaked, I should say, especially looking at superannuation. Some people saying they're going further than Labor on this sort of area. What did you make of what was kind of said yesterday, what was released or just leaked, I should say?
Yeah, well, I mean, it is a leak, so we don't know, you know, whether it is true. I guess there's two sides. So there's the actual what they're doing. So they're talking about, in a sense, lowering the threshold by which people who are paying into superannuation are going to pay high levels of tax on their superannuation. And this is a well-recognized problem with the superannuation system. If you're rich and you can pay more money in, you can effectively reduce your kind of tax.
Mm.
So there's a kind of, you know, if you can afford to save, you can afford to save and get a tax advantage for that. And it was, you know, it's kind of patently unfair system. And the superannuation system, which is designed to, in a sense, be a replacement for the old pension, has a number of inequalities that have substantially benefited people who are more affluent in the system. Labor had been making some inroads into that issue, and there are a number of tax issues that they'd been talking about. And remember, we had this big debate about negative gearing, which is another one that plays more to one particular end of town as opposed to the other. But the government looks like they've actually gone further than Labor's proposal to kind of lower the threshold. The analysis that we've seen so far is if this is true, and we don't know, we've got to wait to May 2nd for the budget, this may raise $2 billion of tax. The government is sort of steadfast in its refusal to increase personal income tax. So you'll remember we got this big cut in personal income tax during the Howard era when the mining boom was on. And what they did was they took this mining boom, which is a kind of temporary phenomena, and they turned turned into this enduring tax cuts. And that has created effectively part of the budget problem that we have today. Mm. That's the revenue problem as opposed to the expenditure problem. The government obviously is attempting to attack the revenue problem by raising new revenue, but they're not reversing those income taxes. So those income taxes look like they're going to stay relatively low, and they're going to adjust to other obvious inconsistencies in the tax system. At some point, we are going to have to deal with the enduring legacy of these tax cuts from the noughties, effectively, that people now see as natural, but have created this kind of enduring systemic revenue problem. So that's kind of interesting to see. If it's true, it's done two things. First, it's allowed the government to address its budget difficulties, so it has some more money to spend. And usually you do want to spend some money on your initiatives, particularly as they're going to be using the budget as the framing device for the election. So the election is not going to be fought on the two pieces of legislation that are ostensibly the trigger. And that's not unusual. If we look at most double dissolutions, so we've had six double dissolutions in the history of Australia, most double dissolutions actually don't fight the election on the bills that are ostensibly the trigger for the election. Mm. They are usually, as they are in this case, a pretext for an election. So the budget is going to be the framing device that the government uses to kind of kick off its election campaign. And can I say, 9 excruciating weeks to go.
Yeah, can I, on that sort of point, so it is going to be a long election campaign. What long. Do you sort of predict having the next 9 weeks?
Well, even as a political scientist, I find the prospect of an unedifying example. Okay, so this is the thing. Election campaigns, in the kind of theory of them, are times when busy people like you and I should sit down and say, politics, let's assess all the policy options. Let's draw up a kind of rational matrix of the issues that concern us and put the position of the candidates on and create a utility-maximizing decision that, demonstrates our rational choice.
Mm.
But actually, elections don't really decide the, people usually have decided how they're going to vote way before an election. So an election is usually focused on partly the ritual of the thing. And don't get me wrong, rituals can be important. A lot of Australian elections are really ritualistic, and they basically mark that we're having an election, that there is this kind of process of legitimising a new government. But most of the time, for the vast majority of people, they know who they're going to vote for, and they do not change their position during the election campaign. And a lot of the election is about that small slice of the electorate who, generally speaking, are the least well-informed about politics, who are going to make up their decision. And so what we see with elections is generally people kind of attune to the issues at the start of the election when it's called. So in the first week, a lot of people are spending a lot of time thinking about what's going on. Then during the middle of the election, however long it is, yep, long or short, people go back to living their lives, and I imagine their happiness index goes up. And then just before they vote, which used to be on election day, then in that last week, they kind of re-engage with the issue again. But increasingly, people are voting early. And that's the thing about elections. They used to be this very kind of predictable campaign. So, kind of the first quarter of the campaign, you establish your policy. The second quarter of the campaign, you rubbish your opponent. The third quarter of the campaign, you elaborate your kind of agenda items. And in the final thing, you ram home your kind of messages. And it's a very structured kind of event.
Mm.
But increasingly, Australians are pre-poll voting, they're doing all this kind of postal vote. So they're actually voting quite early. So they're kind of civic ritual where we were all kind of locked into this temporality of the election campaign has kind of declined. But a 9-week campaign is going to be excruciating. And remember, the politicians who are in office continue to get their travel entitlements until they have their formal election campaign launches.
Right.
And they'll have their election campaign launches really late. So you taxpayers will be paying for all the travel to Western Sydney and Queensland, which are the two states with either the highest proportion or the highest absolute number of marginal seats, for the next 7 or 8 weeks, and then there'll be a launch, and then they'll be on their own dime.
There you go. It is going to be a long 9 weeks. Dr. Peter Chen, thanks so much.
Hey, thank you.
We'll speak to you over the 9 weeks a lot, I'm sure.